Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM on 103.2. Hello to Unity FM in Birmingham, 93.5 in the Midlands, and also, last but not least, Radio Verulam in St Albans. This week we'll be talking to Kate Wiltshire from Wessex Home Improvement Loans, who will be talking about the low-cost finance it provides to financially vulnerable homeowners. We get Tony Gosling's view about the undercover policeman who posed as an eco-activist, which has been in the news recently. Roving reporter Anthea Page talks to Maxwell Steer from the Perian Centre in Bristol about the work of Jungian psychologist Marie-Louise von Franz about dreams. We have the second part of a Robert Louis Stevenson's letters, read by our own Alec Milne, and Trevor Castle will be dropping by later on to read us one of his poems, and Jeff Sparks, of course, has his What's On Guide and a Song of the Week. Well, I'm John Peters Coleman, and without further ado, I'd like to introduce our guest to the studio for this week, Kate Wiltshire. Hello.
Hello, John.
So you are from Wessex Home Improvement Loans.
Yes.
Now, lest people think this might be sort of like product endorsement or sort of an advert, who are Wessex Home Improvement?
Wessex Home Improvement Loans is a community development finance institution. It's alternative banking, if you like, an alternative form of finance. And it's an idea that came over from America, where it has been operating for many years now as a system for providing finance to people who can't get credit on the high street, most often to start their own business and be independent.
Okay, so
that's one of the applications.
So you work in tandem with local authorities?
We do. That's what's different about Wessex Home Improvement Loans. There are other CDFIs, as they're called, who work with local authorities, but we are now working with 19 local authorities across the southwest, and specifically with the housing departments of district
councils.
Okay,
so you're sort of an extension of sort of social services, if you like, as far as you kind of stop people dropping off the bottom of the housing ladder into financial...
Yeah, vulnerable homeowners, particularly the elderly in rural areas, can often find themselves on a very low disposable income in their older years, and that means that maintaining their home, keeping warm even, you know, doing something simple like trying to renew a boiler or put double glazing in, is just not affordable for them, and they can't get a loan from the high street.
So how long have you been going?
Well, it was in 2002 that Wessex was set up, and it was at about the same time as the government was saying that local authorities had to find a different way to use what was their grant funding to private sector housing renewal.
Okay, so obvious question, I suppose. I mean, how have you dealt with the increased influx of inquiries, I suppose, since the Depression has started?
We've had economic problems. Well, thankfully, our referrals have been fairly steady, and I think that's partly to do with the fact that we have diversified our loan scheme so that we can help people to install renewable energy, we can help people to convert their loft or to make an adaptation to their home because of some disability. So it's been extended that it's not simple renewal of their property, but it has lots of other applications as well, and that's made us very flexible and adaptable to people's needs.
Okay, so who do you loan to? I mean, is it sort of just poor people? I mean, middle-class people, for example?
It has to be people who have a low disposable income, effectively, and right. That means that they have a financial assessment to go through with one of our loan advisors, who is very experienced in dealing with vulnerable people and hand-holding them through the process. But always, the referral has to come through the local authority, because they are the people who refer to us and support the loan and help to keep the interest rate at a low 3% to the client.
So how have you found the housing market has affected your institution? House prices have sort of gone down, and they're supposedly set to rocket again in the news this week.
That's a good point, because our loans are always secured, and that has to be secured on what equity is available in the property. So there has to be that room for us, if you like, to secure the loan. And that's simply because it's public funds and has to return to the pot so that it can continue to recycle and be available for somebody else to borrow.
Okay, what sort of interest do you have on this? I mean, you're not obviously sort of loan sharks, and I assume you have to recoup your losses in some sort of legal way.
Well,
how do you do that?
We are a not-for-profit social enterprise, we feel that a social objective is being achieved by what we do. And that, I think that's what makes us different from other high street lenders who have shareholders to take care of. Ours is entirely, as I say, a social dividend that we...
So people don't sort of pay interest back on their loans in the way that
they
we would
do pay
in the bank.
Interest, yes, but that simply covers our costs.
Right.
That's all. There's no private profit for Wessex.
So what sort of variety of things? I mean, you sort of hinted at a few different things, for example, sort of double glazing, renewable energy. I mean, are you sort of open to, you know, what range of ideas are you open to?
Well, all sorts of things. Another might be a first-time buyer's repair loan, because we're particularly, as you mentioned, where properties are more expensive, perhaps a first-time buyer, that first step onto the ladder is quite difficult to make. And the only property that people can afford may be a dilapidated property. Mm. And if it's in the local council's policy to support this kind of loan, then they might make the loan available for them to make the essential repairs. It always has to be essential repairs. It's not things like putting on a nice new conservatory that might increase the value of the property. You know, it's simply to make a decent home standard repair. The government's decent home standard means that the property is watertight, there is a good degree of thermal comfort, and that all the facilities are up to date. You know, decent kitchen, decent bathroom.
How have you found you've had to adapt now that we are under the coalition government? I mean, obviously, new housing policy is going to be different from what Labour had.
Yeah, well, I think that the housing policy is well developed in most councils. I think the thing that they find most difficult at the moment is the fact that since the comprehensive spending review, that there is very, very little grant funding around to invest with Wessex to continue.
So does that mean you've got less money to loan out?
There's less grant funding available for people. So what there is in the pot is having to recycle. Yes, which was what it was intended to do.
Yeah.
But it would be nice to get an injection of further funding to help more people.
Are you sort of looking forward to how housing policy might be envisaged to develop under the coalition and under the Conservative and Lib Dem rule? Or would you rather, you know, what the Labour Party had envisaged was?
Well, I was very comfortable and familiar with the Labour Party housing policy. But I think this is a whole new landscape and we have to wait to see what develops. But I think that it's acknowledged by all. It was in the news the other day that we're heading towards a housing crisis, and it would be nice to be able to meet that need, particularly for people who are more vulnerable.
Okay. So you are but one of, well, I assume many CDFIs. What other...
Yes, indeed. They're all over the country. Most of them may not work exactly as we do, directly with local authorities. But if people want to Google CDFI, or perhaps to access the CDFA website, the Community Development Finance Association, mm-hmm. is kind of the professional body that CDFIs associate with, and they would be able to put anybody who is interested in touch with their local CDFI.
Okay.
Another example of a CDFI is a credit union, and that can provide small, low-cost loans to people who may need, you know, to replace something in their home. But for the larger cost of works, that's the kind of thing that we provide.
Okay, and what would you say was the main benefits going to you to, for example, just going to get an ordinary bank loan?
I think the point is that the people who come to us can't get high street finance, can't get an ordinary bank loan, and that's what we were set up to do, to assist those who are marginalised, if you like, unable to get high street credit.
How can people get in touch with you? What are your contact details?
We always recommend that if people feel they have a need, some problem with their home that needs repair or renewal, they should get in touch with their local authority. We work with 19 local authorities in the southwest, as I said. But if anybody wants any advice on how to contact their council, they can call us on 01823 461099 or visit our website, which is wessexhill.co.uk.
Okay. Well, Kate Wiltshire, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, John.
Environmental activists are still reeling from revelations in the press that you'll have seen, no doubt, that they were infiltrated by the police for nearly 10 years. Mark Kennedy was the gentleman's name in question. We've seen his face, both as an activist and now as a policeman, but not his activist name. And he was outed, in fact, by his girlfriend. I'd like to welcome Tony Gosling to the studio to have a little chat about it.
Hello. Hi, John.
So why is this story so important?
Well, I think the thing that makes it so important is it's very, very rare for any police undercover officer to actually be turned by the activists they're supposed to be spying on. And I think this is the thing that makes this case so fascinating, is that Mark Kennedy himself said that there are 15 more spies that he knows of in environmental and political activist groups. And yet,
is that a wise thing for him to say?
Well, he's now decided that he's really turned on his former employers. He was employed for something like £50,000 a year to infiltrate this group. And yet he's now decided, and of course that is a big tie for many individuals who are working as police infiltrators. That salary keeps them loyal. But he, as one of the rare people who actually broke with that loyalty and decided that he really felt that he had to speak out publicly about the way he'd been treated by his employers, and also many other aspects to do with the infiltration of this group.
Right, let's just rewind a little bit. He was outed by his girlfriend. What, how and why particularly?
Well, she discovered his passport in his real name.
Right. What exactly does this mean if there are now 15 officers still out there? Is this not going to create an enormous amount of paranoia within the movement? Is that a wise thing to say?
Well, I think within environmental activists generally, there is an awareness that their authorities may be trying to infiltrate them. But I think I was quite personally shocked to see that there's so many and so many different groups. And there's a couple of aspects to this which are, I think are really worrying. Firstly, he wasn't just sort of observing what was going on. He was actually quite instrumental in fact, it's arguable that some of these actions that these groups were doing could not have happened without him.
Okay, so is this perhaps suggesting that he pushed them forward or further into committing illegal acts which they could then get arrested?
Well, exactly,
for
entrapment. And the other thing is that that rather than being observing the situation, it seems the police are actually controlling the situation in certain occasions.
Is that that's not necessarily a bad thing though, to take control of a situation?
Well, to control a situation which is leading a whole bunch of other people rather than following a bunch of other people into potential criminal acts is actually very, very serious, you know, and it's led to several, it seems, in this particular case, miscarriages of justice. And one of the biggest problems is here that there are many other police infiltrators, and there are many, many other prosecutions, and the question is how many of those now need to be revisited, and are the police ever going to admit that serious miscarriages of justice have taken place in previous occasions?
This is a bit of a sideline, but I couldn't help harking straight back to a previous interview we've done on the show with members of a group who organised the Big Green Gathering, which was then cancelled because the police took sort of what they deemed to be a very unhealthy large amount of interest in the possible terrorist groupings and gatherings that could gather at a sort of environmental festival. Do you think this is any way sort of related somehow to the fact that there is...
Well, in a way, yes, because both of them are examples of the police interfering in legitimate organising by groups that may have political interests. And so I think in both cases, you know, both of them are stages of a move towards a kind of police state where the police are, rather than watching what's going on and policing it and prosecuting where necessary, they're actually starting to control events.
And in both cases, they clearly see people with an interest in the environment as dangerous.
Yeah, this is the worrying thing, isn't it? You would hope that they would be looking for things like terrorists and whatever, if they exist, and finding them. But it seems that they're using these big budgets to look at environmental terrorists who aren't really terrorists at all.
Do you think there's just an element they don't really understand them, so they need to find out more?
The problem is the secrecy. The problem is that, you know, as I was saying before, potentially we've got many, you know, serious miscarriages of justice where the police are implicated in planning events, being part of planning events, that people have been prosecuted, and yet the police are keeping very quiet that they were even involved.
But then if you do hear of a group that you don't really understand or know about, and there are implications that they might engage in acts such as trying to close down Drax Power Station or engaging in some kind of an act which is against the general public interest, is it not in their duty to try and get involved to find out what's happening?
You can hardly it's not their duty to get involved, no. It's their duty to gather evidence, not to steer the campaign.
Isn't that going to be incredibly difficult without having somebody on the inside who actually knows what's going on in the first place?
That's absolutely... I think it's quite correct to have surveillance on these groups, but not to try and control them. Anyway, to get to the most important point, I think, really here, and that is, how do you discover a police infiltrator?
Right.
How can you notice one? From what's come out from this case with Mark Kennedy, I think there are several things. First of all, inexplicable amounts of money that they've got. I think if you're an activist, you need to be absolutely upfront about where your money's coming from. He was obviously on, he had quite a lot of money. Obviously, he had police expenses as well. There's also someone who is trying to have undue control of a group, trying to be the linchpin, if you want, someone who's trying to take over. And there's also unexplained leave. He went away quite a lot, you know, said he was going abroad and stuff, and so he would disappear off. This is another thing which may be an indicator. And gaps in his past, inconsistencies in his story of who he is. I think these are the sort of main ways to recognise a police infiltrator.
Okay, well, for the time being, Mark Kennedy is now in America, I understand, hiding from all the people that are now very angry with him. But Tony Gosling, I'm sure we'll hear more in the weeks to come. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Now it's time for a song, and we've got Juxtaposed With You by the Super Furry Animals. Splendid from many years ago, Juxtaposed With You by the Super Furry Animals from the album Rings Around the World. Our next feature is by Anthea Page. It's regarding a woman, excuse the pronunciation, it's a mixture of French and German by the looks of it, Mary Louise von Franz, who was born in Munich, the daughter of an Austrian baron. She was a Jungian psychologist and scholar, and she met Jung, J-U-N-G, the famous psychologist, in 1933, and knew him until his death in 1961. Mary Louise founded the C.D. Jung Institute in Zurich. As a psychotherapist, she interpreted 65,000 dreams, primarily practicing in Kuznacht in Switzerland. Von Franz also wrote over 20 volumes on analytical psychology, most notably on fairy tales, as they relate to archetypal or depth psychology, most specifically on amplification of the themes and characters. She also wrote on subjects such as alchemy, discussing the Jungian psychological perspective and active imagination, and describes thus: active imagination is a certain way of meditating imaginatively by which one may deliberately enter into contact with the unconscious and make a conscious connection with psychic phenomena. Hope you're taking notes, by the way. Additionally, she collaborated with Emma Young on The Grail Legend, which discusses the psychological symbolism of the documented legends of the Holy Grail. Well, all this leads us to our very own reporter, Anthea Page, going to a taster evening of films about Marie-Louise von Franz called The Way of the Dream at the Pyrian Centre recently. That's in the St. Paul sort of area. You can now hear this interview with Maxwell Steer about the evening and about the forthcoming event coming in late February.
I'm Michael Maxwell Steer, and we've just done a seminar called The Way of the Dream. We gave a taster evening of that at the Pyrian Centre in Bristol, and we're going to be doing the whole weekend, which is 6.5 hours of film, in February 18th to 20th.
Can you tell us a bit about Jung?
I could tell you more about von Franz, who made these films, than about Jung, but I can certainly tell you a certain amount about Jung. He was a medical doctor, and he became extremely interested in the late 19th century. There was considerable study of psychiatric illness, as we would now call it. It was called alienation in those days. And there was a guy with whom Jung studied called Pierre Janet. And Janet already had quite enlightened ways and ideas about treating people or exploring mental illness with people. And Jung then fell in with Freud, who was making similar experiments in Vienna. Freud, he certainly viewed Jung as his, well, almost as his son, his anointed successor. And then they had a sort of falling out because Jung felt that Freud's idea that everything arose from sexual energy and that mental illness was a byproduct of blocked sexual energy was not the whole story. They had a really very painful break personally and professionally. And Jung felt that Freud's idea that things had fixed meanings was not appropriate, and he felt that the meaning was always dynamic to the individual. And that really is the tradition that he started. It hasn't gained a tremendous amount of support because the idea that there are fixed meanings, that one can know them, is sort of academic psychology, rather rules the roost to this day. But Jung's was a far more dynamic, and von Franz was somebody who'd studied with him and became the founder of the Jung Training Institute in Zurich. And she, in my view, carries the study of dreams further than Jung did because she was a much more cautious, thoughtful person.
How many dreams did she collect?
Well, she didn't exactly collect. What she said was she'd been consulted professionally over 65,000 dreams and had interpreted them and had become, you know, she said dream interpretation on a professional level involves considerable concentration and responsibility, and that later in life she used to beg colleagues not to tell her that their dreams, because then she would have to pay attention to them and then she couldn't pay attention to anything else. And she had just an encyclopedic awareness of imagery as it occurs in dream.
Did she believe in dreams?
I think the answer is yes. It's not necessarily believing in dreams per se, it's really listening to dreams, so that you learn what they're trying to say to you and, you know, rather than necessarily taking them at face value. The language of dreams was incredibly little understood, and it remains a great area of ignorance, and people who consider themselves sort of psychologically aware in all sorts of ways are quite ignorant when it comes to dreams. Dreams are the main thing that actually tells us about ourselves. And therefore, it seems to me that if one wants to, as it were, get it from the inside the horse's head, you actually need to be aware to study how dreams work so that you can actually understand your own.
Do you think people are a bit afraid to talk about their dreams?
Without doubt, especially nowadays when people are very ill at ease with any idea of the spiritual or the transcendent. Anything that goes beyond the limits of rationality is viewed as highly suspect.
So why are you interested in dreams?
Why? I think in these particular films, there is a sort of encapsulation of wisdom that I haven't found anywhere else. And I, like many people in the world, have been looking for ways to discover how to live a life that works for me and works, you know, harmoniously with the world and other people, and also but bring some dynamic to it. And I have found that what has really changed my life is becoming aware of my dreams and responding to them has made me feel in tune with myself, and that has also made me conscious of what I have to give and have the courage to stand in my own space.
The films tackle certain aspects of dreams. Can you just expand on that?
There are 20 films in this weekend. 7 of them form the introduction, which are about the process of dreaming. There are then 5 films, each about 25 minutes, that centre on men's dreams or ideas that that feature in men's dreams, then five that feature ideas that predominantly occur in women's dreams. And then there's a final three, which are to do with relationships and end-of-life issues.
In the film, we saw that some people, when they're dying, actually have a kind of premonition dream.
Yes, I think that what von Franz says, that in the early part of life, dreams tend to be about outwardness and about, you know, making one's way in the world, one thing and another. And then that changes in the middle period. And when you come towards death, regardless actually of the age, if there is a sensation that death is approaching for the individual, the dreams cease to be about struggle and they become about a natural transition. People see tubes of light, or they see candles, or they find themselves feeling they're entering an area of light. And that the dreams of death that occur earlier in life, which are to do where the death actually represents change. When real physical death is discussed, this kind of dream doesn't come at all. It's a natural transition.
Is there any link between dreams and the tarot?
Well, yes.
The reason I ask that is because you mentioned death meaning change, and that is very much a tarot symbol.
Quite. Undoubtedly, there's a relationship because they express archetypal processes in life. You know, how we do evolve, how we do change, and it does feel scary when we evolve from one aspect of being to another in our lives. I know that very, very well. So, of course, there's a link, and the tarot is a manifestation, as is the I Ching or other divinatory methods, is the manifestation of synchronicity, how we are guided to choose certain cards, and then that illuminates our next steps or what is current in our life. So, yes, they're both manifestations of the unconscious.
So tell us more about von Franz.
I can't tell you a great deal more about von Franz. I tried to meet her at the end of her life. I'd seen the films in the late 80s, and they made an indelible impression. And I tried to see, because I was working as a journalist myself at the time, and I tried to see if I could get to interview her, but she was unfortunately already too ill by that time. She chose not to marry. She says in the films that there were people she was attracted to, and she had dreams which told her not to do it, and so she never did marry. And I think probably the world has gained from that, because she put all her energies into writing her books instead of what might have been her children. And I feel there's a legacy of indelible richness here, and it's my humble job to try and bring that to people and hope they'll be interested and help people to find meaning in their lives.
Do you think she ever regret it, though, not being married, and maybe wish she hadn't had to dream?
I can't possibly tell you that. I never met her. I know nothing. I know only what she says in the film. I can't tell you.
So tell us more about the event coming up.
The Way of the Dream is going to be shown at the Pierian Centre in St Paul's in Bristol, February 18th to the 20th. Starts on a Friday evening and it goes through to Sunday lunchtime. I think it's £125. There are some reductions, and if people come as couples, there's a reduction. And that includes a Friday dinner. The weekend is a sort of collegiate affair. People are encouraged to form small groups and discuss the film amongst themselves.
So before we go, what's your most memorable dream?
My most memorable dream is unquestionably a dream in which Cy Barber appeared to me. And what happened in this dream was that I had never heard his name before. I woke in my dream and I saw what I can only describe as a luminous darkness. And it's like what happens when you turn a phone on. The screen is alight but is actually black. Suddenly, a sort of lace curtain was lowered in front of a fairground booth, and a voice in my ear said, "This is Cy Barber, and I must give him a gift." And I was absolutely elated. I had no idea that he was a person or anything, but it was a very, very powerful sort of high, we'll say high energy, I mean sort of really elevated feeling in the dream, transcendent dream. And I woke feeling immensely empowered by it. So that, I've had many, but that is the standout dream for me.
And how did you find out who he was?
I didn't find out. I just mentioned the dream about 9 months later when I was talking to somebody, because this was in the late 80s. And this person said to me, oh, yes, Cy Barbara's a real person. I know that. But I don't know anything about him. I don't know where he lives, but he is a real person. And then with that information, I think I went to a bookshop or something and found a book about him. And then I was led through that to somebody who was his English representative. And the long short of it was I ended up going to make a documentary about Cy Barber for Radio 4.
Who is Cy Barber?
Well, Cy Barber is an Indian teacher. The word guru just means teacher in India. He's a person of extraordinary energy who is now, I suppose, in his 80s. He does appear to people all over the world. He's an astonishing psychic figure. It has to be said there are certain rumours surrounding him which are not altogether agreeable. My issue around that is feeling him very much as a inner teacher. I am uncomfortable about these rumours, which I believe to be true. I find that I have a difficulty in knowing that somebody may not be a very outright person, whilst at the same time also knowing that I've received astonishing spiritual gifts through him.
Well, thank you to Anthea Page, and thank you also to Maxwell Steer at the Pirin Centre here in Bristol. Time for a little bit more music, and this is Badly Drawn Boy from the Hour of the Bewilderment Beats, and the track is called Say It Again.
One, two, three, four. You squeeze the life right out of me like sap in the juice of a bumblebee. Then you call me honey. You say it once and it isn't funny. When you say it again,
yeah, 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 yeah.
Now inside there's a style going on, a head full of dreams, only room for one. Now I know you can't live without me, but I've no doubt that you'll never doubt me like you did before.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And we're pumping our love into the sea. I'm full bodied and bursting with energy. Cold blooded, your engines are running. But where you're going, I'm not coming, 'cause I'm happy.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Happy.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Say it again. Say it again.
Say it again.
Say it again.
And that was Badly Drawn Boy with Say It Again. Well, here is Alec Milne to read the second part of the selected letters of Robert Louis Stevenson, edited by Ernest McHugh. The music, which you hear, is Duff, and it's performed by Concerto Caledonia.
Selected Letters of Robert Louis Stevenson. On 26th July 1873, Stevenson paid what he was later to call a very fortunate visit to Cockfield Rectory in Suffolk, the home of his cousin Maud and her husband Professor Churchill Babington. It was a turning point in his life. At a critical time, he gained the friendship of Francis Sitwell and Sidney Colvin. Francis Jane Fanshawe was a member of a long-established Anglo-Irish family which had fallen on hard times. She married in 1869 the Reverend Albert Hurt Sitwell and lived with him briefly in Calcutta and then in the East End of London, where he was first a curate, then a vicar in Stepney. Albert Sitwell was described as a man of unfortunate temperament and uncongenial habits, and we are told that the couple were not well matched. Whatever the problem, it may have been drink, the marriage fell under greater strain when, in 1869, Sitwell was given the living in Minster, a village on the Isle of Thanet, near Ramsgate. Frances seemed to have decided to break away from her husband following the death of the elder of her two sons, Frederick, aged 12, in 1873. It was at this sad and difficult time in her own life that Mrs. Sitwell, accompanied by her surviving son Francis Albert, Bertie, a boy of 10, came to Cockfield to stay with her close friend Maud Babington. Sidney Colvin was the younger son of Bazette David Colvin, a partner in a leading firm of East India merchants, and his wife Mary Stuart. Both sides of the family had been connected with India, either as merchants or as administrators in the old East India Company. He went up to Trinity College, Cambridge, in 1863, and was third in the first class of the classical tripos in 1867. He was made a fellow of Trinity in 1868. Stevenson's new friends recognised his potential as a writer and saw their task to strengthen, encourage and steady him. The long diary letters that RLS wrote to Mrs. Sitwell over the next 2 years constitute a remarkable and touching record of the young man's slow growth to maturity. To her, he poured out his feelings of unhappiness and near despair over the religious conflict with his father, and what he saw is his parents' lack of understanding. He confided his ambitions and disappointments in his literary work and received encouragement in return, although there can be no doubt of his love and emotional dependence on Mrs. Sitwell as she progressed from being Claire to his Madonna. There was something unreal about the relationship. One feels that he treated her with the reverence accorded to a goddess rather than that of a lover. With characteristic generosity and kindness, Colvin helped and encouraged RLS in his literary aspirations by introducing him to publishers and editors and tirelessly promoting his interests. At first, as he later admitted, Stevenson was somewhat in awe of this austere and rather reserved man, but for the rest of his life he regarded Colvin as his literary mentor and closest friend. Colvin's own loyalty and unselfish devotion, both to Stevenson himself and later to his memory, never faltered. Letter to Francis Sitwell. Monday, 1st September 1873, 17 Heriot Row. I've arrived, as you see, without accident, but I never had a more wretched journey in my life. We were packed very tightly all the way, and I was haunted by a face that I saw looking out of a window in London that made me very sad. I could not settle to read anything. I bought Darwin's latest book, The Expression of Emotion in Man and Animals, in despair, for I knew I could generally read Darwin, but it was a failure. However, the book served me in good stead, for when a couple of children got in at Newcastle, I struck up a great friendship with them on the strength of the illustrations. These two children, a girl of 9 and a boy of 6, had never before travelled in a railway, so that everything was a glory to them, and they never tired of watching the telegraph posts and trees and hedges go racing past at the tail of the train, and the girl, I found, quite entered into the most daring personifications that I could make. A little way on, about Alnmouth, they had their first sight of the sea, and it was wonderful how loath they were to believe that what they saw was water. Indeed, it was very still and grey and solid-looking under the sky to match. It was worth the fare, yet a little further on, to see the delight of the girl when she passed into another country with the black tweed under our feet, crossed by the lamps of the passenger bridge. I remember the first time I had gone into another country over the same river from the other side. Bob was not at the station when I arrived, but a friend of his bought me a letter, and he is to be in the first thing tomorrow. I am very tired, dear, and somewhat depressed after all that has happened. Do you know, I think yesterday and the day before were the two happiest days of my life? It seems strange that I should prefer them to what has gone before, and yet, after all, perhaps not. Oh, God, I feel very hollow and strange just now. I had to go out to get supper, and the streets were wonderfully cool and dark, with all sorts of curious illuminations at odd corners from the lamps. But I couldn't help fancying, as I went along, all sorts of foolish things. Chansons about showing all these places to you, Claire, some other night which is not to be. Dear, I would not have missed last month for eternity. I trust you were well all today, and that Le Chapelain did not trouble you. Give all sorts of good messages to the Sol Laissé, B. Sitwell, and say what is necessary if you like, or if you think anything necessary, to the Curate of Cumberworth and the Vicar of Roost. Goodbye, my dear. Ever yours, R.L.S. To Francis Sitwell, Tuesday, 9 September 1873, 17 Heriot Row. I was sitting up here, working away at John Knox, when the door opened and Bob came in. At first I thought he was drunk. He came in with his hands over his face and sank down in the chair and began to sob. He was scarcely able to talk at first, but he found voice at last. And then I found out he had come to see me, had met my father on the way, and had just brought to an end an interview with him. There is now at least one person in the world who knows what I have to face. Damn me for facing it, as I sometimes think, in weak moments. But what a tempest of emotion my father can raise when he is really excited. It seems that this poor cousin of mine has hated Bob and me all through his life, that our words have been sharp poison to him, and our opinions horrible, and our presence an intolerable burthen. He always met us as friends. He was too weak, it seemed, to show us what he disliked and what shocked him, and led us on, unconsciously, I dare say, to play with him, cards down, and keep nothing secret. A little before death he relieved his feelings to my father, Bob. Bob, he said, was a blight, a mildew. It was a matter of wonder to him how God should have made him such a man. I was the one depraved and hideous one who could endure Bob's presence. Un sur vita in infinitum. My father's interview with Bob had been long coming, and has now come. I am so tired at heart and tired in body that I can only tell you the result tonight. They shook hands. My father said he wished him all happiness, but prayed him as one favour that could be done him, that he should never see him between the eyes again. And so parted my father, my friend. Tomorrow I shall have more details.
Thank you very much to our very own Alec Milne there for reading us one of Robert Louis Stevenson's letters. Just to remind you, we have got Treasure Island being read by Malcolm Greaves coming up soon. Okay, well, here is Mr. Tim Burrows, our poet for the week. Hello.
Hi, John.
You are a mobile phone poet. You have your iPhone with the poetry on.
Yes, it hasn't gone onto paper yet. But yeah, this is an elegy for Captain Beefheart, who sadly died just before Christmas.
Okay.
Who is the great musician of the Captain Beefheart, the magic band. Star-studded, wind-blown, driven by the current, the electric current of change. Change in ways of expressing the edge of the possible, edged with the moment, with the eye of a painter, mouthed with the mouth of a trout, clothed in a sparkly jacket, with decals licked by the groan of a howling wolf. Climbing fitfully from a pool full of blue dreams, blown by a storm of dust off the Mojave, lipped by the rasping of a harmonica, expressing a tune in tune with the infinite. Captain Beefheart, we salute you and we will miss you. The world has lost a whirlpool of imagination.
Thank you. Well, what else do you have for us?
Well, The next one's kind of a bit more serious. You know, we've had these floods in Australia. I've done a lot of kind of reading about global warming, so this is a global warming poem.
Okay.
It's called Denied Reality, Global Warming on TV. How long will we sit watching the weather emerging from the east, watching for portents on TV of global warming? The wrenching of the earth into abnormal spasms, another turn on the screw of idiotic self-destruction. We sit and watch, we sit and wait. We watch Filipinos drown. We watch Bangladeshis drown. We watch Africans die of thirst trying to escape from war and heat. We watch the drought of 10 years, the skulls of dead cattle in Australia. We watch the forest burn homes in Greece and Los Angeles. We watch typhoons submerge and drown, drown the poor black and white trash in New Orleans, where National Guards shoot to protect property, not people. We all sit and we watch. We sit and we hide our heads in our hands. It's not Hitler this time. It's our planet that threatens another Holocaust. More asphyxiating gas, but not in a full shower, in an all-encompassing heat haze, as it starts to bubble through the permafrost, where the ice in Siberia is melted, where the ice in Greenland is melted, while the glaciers disappear in the Alps, the Andes and the Himalayas, as polar bears drown in the iceless sea. This is all too much for us to see, so it's business as usual until there's no more TV to sit and watch in denied reality.
There have been some incredibly moving stories, and particularly photographs of I've noticed, I assume that you've noticed too, in relation to these floods, of sort of people are perched on top of their car, struggling, and only seconds after the photo is taken, for them to be sort of swept away and killed. I mean, particularly in relation to some people who sort of moan about the state of teenagers, I would point them to the story of the 13-year-old boy who sacrificed himself to make sure that his younger brother was safe. And I found that very moving, very moving. Do you have anything else for us before you depart for another week to be put into the poet's cupboard?
Only to be emerged next week. Yeah, this one's a bit more cheerful. This is about, I try to play the guitar and try to pick up bits of guitar licks from other guitarists.
Okay.
So this is about that process, because it's like about the creative process.
Okay.
I like picking past phrases, licks from the great, echoes of scales of brilliance formed and shaped by long nights and days of practice, performance, listening, absorbing, copying, reforming, moulding, translating, working the shapes, till the hard-tipped fingers bleed, to feel, to know, to link in that special, oh-so-special world that some call art, but others call spirituality. The pulse of imagination forming a bridge, gilt, golden, molten, shining like the stars, reflecting the smallness of each and everyone's existence. The film of life, the shadow of existence, the slow, ponderous track, the human tread, films of dust on the petri glass of passing time.
Until next time, merci and adieu.
Thank you, John. Cheers.
Well, here he is, the man in black, the Bristol version. Hello, Jeff, and please tell us what is on this week and give us your song of the week.
Thank you. Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 28th of January, Guns to Roses will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30pm and tickets are £10 in advance. Also on Friday, 28th of January, Devil Sold His Soul will be performing with support from Heights and also Evita at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 6:30pm and tickets are £7.50 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I present The Who. This is the track Early Morning Cold Taxi, which was previously unreleased until it was included on this box set 30 Years of Maximum R&B, which was released in 1994.
3:36, it's cold. I know I'm growing old. With life's beside on the downward slope. It's in my own hands, I know I'll cope. My girl's with me and all my friends can see. Here I am again, early morning cold taxi. Early morning cold taxi. Done it before, do it again. Though from experience, it's not in vain. She's the best I've had, I cannot see. What someone else can do to me. It's a long way home, but love's so warm, you'll see. Here I am again, early morning cold taxi. Early morning cold taxi. Early morning cold taxi. Each time I do it, I feel so down and out. Early morning cold taxi. Though my mind thinks strange, I'll keep on, no doubt. 3:36, it's cold. I know I'm growing old. One day we'll be wed. This I know, but it's what she said. Then no.
That was The Who with Early Morning Cold Taxi from the box set 30 Years of Maximum R&B. For more information on the band, you can check out www.thewho.com. On to Saturday, 29th of January, The Bones will be performing at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. Finally, on Sunday, 30th of January, Zoe Francis will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. The gig starts at 4 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you, Jeff. Oh, always good to know there is yet another Guns N' Roses tribute in town. I think you can spend your entire life going to see that and Thin Lizzy tributes if you tried hard enough. Well, that's all from Dialect this week. Thank you very much to our studio guest, Kate Wiltshire. Thank you also to Tony Gosling and Anthea Page for their contributions. We had a letter read by Alec Milne. Tim Burrows came in and read us a poem. And Jeff Sparks wrote the What's On guide. The studio engineer was Michael Noyce and the producer was Michaela Dennis. I'm John Peters Coleman, not forgetting, of course. If you would like to listen again or catch up with any of our previous shows, you can find us on dialectradio.co.uk and, of course, on the Bristol Community Radio website, bcfm.org.uk. Goodbye from me, and I'll see you next week.
Yo. These are the steps that we need to take to build. To build for our future, for the next generation. Nate, Cyclonius, and Dark Matter. Let's build a new foundation, start with communication. And if you're on this team, you're on the same vibration. Only then can we create something amazing. Identity is the key with the right education. I'm sick of Satan waiting. We need a bunch of brave men who can stand up and look into the eyes of Satan. Or any corporation, or anyone that's hating, or anything that's blocking us from our destination. Teach the youth the truth about who they are. They're not gangsters or hoes, they're all superstars. We need some unity, no one in a different class. You wanna know your future? Get to know your past. Grow our own food so we can get the minerals. Illegalize anything that stops us being spiritual. Kill the television so the children can't be fooled. Raise them in a household, that's where they should all be schooled.
You're sick and tired of living this way. And honestly down cause you wanna see change. We love our people more than our ways. That's what we're trying to build with our brothers today. Cause you see that we're living in vain. The way that we're living every day is insane. They say we're free but we're mentally chained. That's what we're trying to build with our brothers today.
This is for the youths on the road that wanna grow, that wanna live past 30 and circle the globe. The only guarantee you receive from life is death. So if we're gonna live, we might as well live it the best. Watch the thoughts that you keep, cause they always manifest. Follow steps from the ancestors to help your quest. My life's blessed, cause I find inner peace, minus the stress from the things I don't need. Be the ruler of your destiny, control your legacy. Build with your brother if he brings good energy. Wolves and sheep's clothing only bring treachery. Never follow fashion, set the pattern for the remedy. Real friends will always be, fake ones will come around. Glued to the screen like a theme, fam, only Dan. I love the next gen, so I put the pad to pen. The flower needs to stem from the start to the end.
Sick and tired of living this way. And honestly, down cause you wanna see change. We love our people more than our ways. That's what we're trying to build with our brothers today. Cause you see that we're living in pain. The way that we're living every day is insane. They say we're free but we're mentally chained. That's what we're trying to build with our brothers today.
Have to build like the structures with the mortar. Free like the sun, moon, stars and the waters. Have your fathers raising families with sons, wives and daughters. Slaves free your troubled minds, escaping all your quarters. In this new age of man-made days that are so crazed. Have to hold your sanity, we're on the last page. Open book that's everlasting. Minutes keep on passing while my seatbelt is passing. In my mind I'm asking, does this man-made powerhouse cover us with any doubts? As I put a split resting on my mouth. This is a land of insecurities. There's no assurity that any cure would be the way to see us torn and free. Gotta be or you can be. Positive mentality is the only way that you will thrive in this reality. But certain man that's hold up know what time it is. Making differences and changing life by how they really live.
You're sick and tired of living this way. And honestly down cause you wanna see change. We love our people more than our ways. That's what we're trying to build with our brothers today. Cause you see that we're living in pain. The way that we're living every day is insane. They say we're free but we're mentally chained. That's why we're trying to build with our brothers today. If you're sick and tired of living this way. And honestly down cause you wanna see change. We love our people more than our ways. That's why we're trying to build with our brothers today. Cause you see that we're living in pain.